Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Coming up today, Emily McCord with Politics Ohio. Later in the program, Aritha Trass is the Women Veterans Program Manager at the Dayton VA Center. She'll tell us what's going on there. First, continuing our series of faculty readings from the 2011 Antioch Writers Workshop, Joyce Dyer is the author of four books and an English professor at Hiram College in Ohio. Here she reads from an essay that originally appeared in Come What May, an anthology of writings about chance. It's called Reunion.
Two teeth come toward me in the double olive bar and grill. I'm the beaver, the bald man attached to them laughs. He kisses me on the cheek and I feel porcelain. As soon as he walks away, I hurry to the table where a yearbook is displayed and try to find a picture of someone nicknamed for a huge aquatic rodent. No luck. Everything's a puzzle to me tonight, the Friday kickoff of our 40th class reunion. About 100 people are standing in the party room of the Double Olive in Akron, Ohio. I'm one of them. Another is the beaver. Who this guy is, though, is anybody's guess. Here we are, pressed together again, the way we had been on Friday nights at the Waterloo, the restaurant where we gathered after football games. It's hot. Many of us are complaining about how uncomfortable we are. We wouldn't have worried about things like the temperature 40 years ago. There's a buffet set up in the room, greasy food, little fried hot dogs and sausages, sauerkraut balls. I pass it by. I can't believe anyone our age still eats like this. I make my way to the cash bar and order bottled water. I don't need to feel any fuzzier than I already do. Across the room, I see Donald, my former neighbor. I have no trouble recognizing him. He's better looking than he ever was, if that's possible. He's in a California golf shirt, and I'm suddenly 17. I had no idea he would be here. He lives on the West Coast. I guess I hadn't thought there was any chance at all, that he would travel all this way for a high school reunion. Although I should be happy to see him, I'm not. It's extremely pleasant to look at him, but I don't want him here. I hadn't thought about him in all this time, and I don't want to think about him now. I suddenly wish I could get my $50 back for this two-day event and just leave. He's busy talking to women, laughing and tossing back his head. I don't remember this shy, silent boy ever behaving this way, and it unsettles me. The very idea of him unsettles me, though I don't even know what I mean by this when the thought first arrives. He's glamorous. His hair and eyebrows are still thick. A startling gray now, with just a hint of another color I can't quite name. He seems to have ridden in on the surf. Arisen up from a vineyard in Napa Valley, a New Age Dionysus. He holds a glass full of red wine. Its stem winds like a tendril up through his palm, and its bowl rests against his chest like a little human heart. "Didn't you date him?" my old friend Kathy screams at me, fluttering her wrists a little. The Muzak makes it hard to hear as everyone is talking too loudly. "Oh, no," I say, "shh." There had been one date. But it wasn't something I cared to remember. 2 weeks before the Christmas formal my senior year, my sweet mother, sure that I'd be going alone as I had to all the other dances before that one, had hailed Donald's mother for a minute while they were both shoveling their steps, summoned her to the privet hedge that divided their properties, and asked if perhaps her son could take me to the dance. He was shy too. His mother liked our family and accepted the invitation. So, Donald didn't ask me, and I didn't ask him. Neither of us asked, and neither was asked. Don just showed up. The night of the dance, he appeared at my door with a corsage and a car, the two things I needed a boy for. Okay, it's not quite true that I haven't thought about him for 40 years. I've written about him in a book. Dear God, has he read it yet? Read what I said about him? That's what I keep thinking as I watch him across the room. 2 years before the reunion, I published a memoir about growing up in Akron in Rubber Town, and in it, I confess my love for Donald Fritz. He was my first romance, though I'm embarrassed to tell you, it was closer to the kind where drums beat in the background than the kind with the violins. In the book's pages, I describe the way Donald stood on the little balcony outside his bedroom on hot summer nights and how I watched the bottom of his pajamas slide softly over his hip bone and loved the way his flesh curved in. How could I have been so stupid? Did I think he would just disappear from the earth the moment the word showed up on my computer screen? Just vanish to be replaced by a couple of black lines? I didn't even name him, but if he's read the book, he'll know what I've done. The object of my first desire, the boy whose crotch I'd written about in some detail, is only a few feet away. Does he know? My friend Kathy asks, as if she's inside my brain. Huh? I say, pretending she's puzzled me. Has Don read the book? Does he know about the scene? Kathy read it a year ago. Oh, I say, I really don't know. You've got to ask him, she says. You can't spend the rest of your life worrying about this. I look across the room, knowing what I have to do, knowing that my friend is right, and wishing there was some way to put Don back on the plane. After all, he doesn't live in Ohio anymore. I do. He's surrounded by a group of pretty women who look as if they've just reached a watering hole in some great desert. The prettiest of them all is his own wife, the stewardess. She's thin, dark, perfectly groomed. She looks like a Hollywood movie star. Hello, I say, pushing toward him. I want this over, squeezing in between several women who look like shoppers at the Giant Eagle lunching for free samples of something really tasty and expensive, shrimp or gorgonzola cheese. You look great, he says to me when he hears me speak, and I know he doesn't know who I am. His eyes go right to the name tag. Joyce Coyne, he says, you look great. How are you? I ask. Great. Do you know my wife? I turn to his wife, who's smiling in our direction. Her smile is a little crooked. She must get tired of this. I know you, she says. She talks about the high school Christmas dance Don and I attended together. Cute picture. I'd forgotten there'd been one, but there had. Oh, he didn't really ask me to go, I say. That's not what he tells me, she laughs, her lips a little tight. We were shy. Our mothers arranged it, I tell her. An arranged date, sort of like an arranged marriage. I've gone too far again. Said the wrong thing. Just as 2 years earlier, I'd written the wrong thing, though I was only telling the truth. We didn't say a word to each other the entire night, I add. If I tell her this, she'll surely know there was no kiss. We'd behave like two virgins, which, of course, we were. I didn't say that about the virgins, though. She has a story of her own to tell. Shy, she says. When Don and I started dating, I found a little black book full of women's addresses and phone numbers. I asked him about it, and he said it was nothing. I burned it. Don, I say, that doesn't sound like our Don. Our Don? How did that slip out? This woman has been married to this man for 35 years. It's really time for me to give him up. He never was mine anyway. She turns to someone else, and then Don is in front of me. Words begin to spill out of him, and I'm pretty certain this is not the Don who grew up in the house next to mine. He's Don the imposter, and I look for a mask. Look for a tiny seam under the chin or an extra circle around an eye. He never talked when I knew him, didn't even smile. There are other women pushing toward Don now. I take my leave. I ease back, slip away. I return to Kathy. She's exactly where I left her, waiting for my report. And then the whole room tilts. The axis of the world shifts as Don pushes toward us with his glass of Cabernet. Here he comes, Kathy says. There's a trail of women behind him like a meteor shower. So, Kathy says to him the moment he's in view, Have you read Joyce's latest book? You're in it, I whisper and smile, hoping that the noise of the room will drown out my words. I don't want him to hear what I've said, but I know I have to say it. Something forces a confession. Didn't know you even wrote. How do I come across? He says, amused. She thought you were hot, Kathy says. I'm hoping I haven't heard it correctly, or at least that Don hasn't. Don's father was always a little deaf, so maybe Don is too. Even though Don looks just like George Clooney, only better, he's the same age as the rest of us. No, he says, emitting a loud laugh. You're kidding. Could you get me the book? I tell him I'll try to remember to bring a few copies tomorrow. The reunion committee had asked me to sell them both nights, but I've forgotten them today. Both Kathy and Don hug me, and then they hug each other. There's something unnerving about our farewell.
You're listening to Joyce Dyer's presentation at the 2011 Antioch Writers' Workshop. It's an essay that appeared in Come What May, an anthology of writings about chance. Here's part two of her presentation, Reunion.
On Saturday night, I make sure I arrive at the Rosemont Country Club after cocktail hour is over. No sign of Don. I'm relieved. I've decided to bring just a few books, and I place them on the far end of a table in the hall outside the dining room. Because I'm late, everyone is already seated for dinner. Things are working out perfectly. Alone in the hall, I mix the books with commemorative programs and flyers the committee has brought. The book is completely inconspicuous, just another souvenir hidden behind larger stacks. I pick up my name tag and creep into the dining room. The buffet features cream sauces, white and tan, and the after-dinner program is full of silly questions and trivia, just what we want. One man wins an award for having 21 grandchildren, but there are no questions about who lusted for the neighbor boy and then lived to tell about it or write about it. There are no awards for that. There are a few impromptu speeches. Classmates drift to the front of the room and speak into a microphone. A member of the committee reads the names of those in our class who have died. The list is long, 29, 30, and then I stop counting as the names continue to be read. Some people wander from group to group, some dance, a few sit quietly with new lovers they have brought, showing them off, hoping for another chance. Several begin to move into the hall to browse for souvenirs, so I hurry to the table and peddle memories. No one can get enough of them tonight. My books sell quickly, just as I had hoped. They soon are gone. Then I see Don. Borne by flocks of women who hover in his path, he floats into the hall and lands right beside the table. As suddenly as they appeared, the women vanish. Only Don remains. I don't see where they've gone, but I hear the rustle of fabric like silky wings. His eyes are as wide and clear and innocent as I remember them. They do not surprise me, but his words do. They're spilling out again the way they had the night before. So, could I buy one, he says. He hasn't forgotten my book, and he's pulling money from his wallet at the same time that he looks at me. Gone, I'm afraid, Don. We're alone. There's nothing left to buy, nothing left to look at. I think there's nothing left to say. You know, he says, I had a great time that night we went to the Christmas dance. What was that called? The snowball? Snowflake? Geez, that was great. Mistletoe, I say. This much I remember. And the glittering white sleigh with a queen and a court sad and Frankie Reynolds and his orchestra serenade everyone in the high school cafeteria. But I don't remember the other part. I don't remember having had any fun at all the way that Don recalls we did. You know, Don, I don't think either of us really did have a very good time. Oh, no, he says, you're wrong. It was lots of fun. I'll always remember it. But we didn't talk. I say, and your mother made you go with me. That's not right, he says. No one ever made me ask you out. I wanted to. Are you kidding? For the life of me, I don't know what he's talking about. It was one of the worst evenings of my life that day, and he remembers enjoying it. It seems as if I don't know what anyone is talking about tonight. There have been so many things that have borne no resemblance to the truth as I remember it. There was a testimony at dinner by an African-American man who had been in three wars since his graduation from Garfield High, Vietnam, Desert Storm in Afghanistan and won 2 Purple Hearts. He's spoken to a microphone and said the thing that had sustained him on the combat field was the complete absence of racial hatred at Garfield, the absence of any enemies there. He was saying this about a time when blacks couldn't even buy property in Firestone Park, the neighborhood where our school sat and where those of us who were white all had lived. It wasn't like that, I want to tell him. Then there's the beaver. He still isn't making any sense to me. And, of course, there's Donald standing here telling me we had some kind of fairy tale date 40 years ago. And there's his enormous ease with women and language that makes him unrecognizable. I'm even beginning to wonder whether my early memory of Donald standing on that romantic little balcony was based on anything more substantial than the night air. Maybe he never stood there at all. Maybe the balcony didn't even exist. Maybe he'll read my book one day and write to me and tell me I have everything wrong. But I don't want him to write. It's not because I fear some great romance will flame up between us if he does, ruining both our lives. What we had was never about romance, the once I may have thought it was. And it's not about romance now. I don't want him to write because I don't want him to correct a single thing. It doesn't matter if I have it wrong. Memory, I've come to understand, is private ground no one else can trespass on. It's not a public place at all, with benches where others come to sit so they can figure out our lives. No cameras are allowed here. Memory isn't an invention exactly, and certainly not a lie, never a lie. That's not why we post a no trespassing sign and keep other people out, because we're afraid of getting caught. I didn't make up a single thing when I wrote about Don, but the tricky part is that he didn't either when he told me about the Christmas dance. Both things were true. Our memories sometimes move old furniture around so that we can rest comfortably in the present. We create a world that explains to us the person we have become. We build the stage that makes our entrance possible, sometimes adding a balcony. We write the script. We light the scenery with stars or disco balls and a high school dance. We create the place we later say we've occupied. It's about respecting property. Even if there's something wrong with my balcony or Don's school cafeteria where the dance was held, neither of us will raise complaint. I will let Don remember himself the way he wants to, always, always as a Casanova, as a young man who even in high school was skilled with women, a raconteur, a great lover who could rescue the whole female sex from self-loathing and unhappiness if he wanted to. Don needs to believe that it was here in high school where he began to learn the love of women, the love that would define him. That love had to begin with me, because I was the first girl he handed flowers to, even though his mother made him. So I must let him think it did. Must let him think he held his black address book in his hands even then, that my name was the first to be recorded. And I won't correct the soldier. I'll let him hold on to the memory that seems so false to me. It's the thing that kept him standing while the world drilled bullets through his tender flesh. And I'll let the beaver be the beaver. Let him hold on to whatever it is that joke about his teeth provides him with. I'll just laugh the way he wants me to. Me? I need to believe my imagination was the salvation of the lonely, shy girl I always thought myself to be, because the truth is that any strength I've had since is connected to its circuitry. Don was standing on that balcony on hot summer nights, even if he wasn't there, and he had to be wordless on our date because the rest of my life would be spent writing the script that would let him speak. Language had to come to rescue me, and Donald Fretz was a handsome mute who showed me this. We never really wanted each other, Don and I. We wanted only from the other the thing that would let us make sense of our own lives. We wanted a chance. Our desire for that was the far greater than any real desire to fall in love. For a short time, we were together, then we weren't anymore. He would leave me soon for other women, but I wouldn't mind. I would leave him, too. We'd served our purpose in the other's life. After all, we were only neighbors. Thank you.
Author Joyce Dyer is an English professor at Hiram College in Ohio, reading from her essay Reunion at the 2011 Antioch Writers' Workshop. We'll have more readings from the workshop in October. This is WISO Weekend. The Dayton VA Center is the third oldest medical center in the VA system. They offer both primary and acute care services. The center is also home to a community living center and several rehabilitation programs. In 2010, the VA Center implemented a comprehensive health care program that offers more on-site services to female veterans, and the care they provide reaches anywhere between 1,600 and 3,000 women. Maritha Trass is the Women Veterans Program Manager. She's worked at the VA Center for 16 years and says the initiatives made in 2010 were ahead of recent national directives to provide better services to women veterans put out by the Department of Veterans Affairs. And Trass says there are more changes on the way.
In the fall, September or October of this year, we'll actually be opening a separate space or a new facility, if you will, for our women veterans. Well, they'll actually have a private entrance, their own waiting area, such as we have now, but it will be about 4,954 square feet, and I can tell you they are extremely excited about this transition that's going to occur here in the next couple of months.
And do you find that women are getting the message that you're there to serve them? It seems there is maybe a small percentage of veterans who don't know what services are available for them.
You are absolutely correct in terms of women still a percentage not knowing. I can tell you we are out at Stand Downs, and we have a mobile unit here that actually goes out into the community, and we become, you know, we're an integral part of that. In terms of outreach for our veterans in the community in surrounding counties. And so one thing that is actually coming up that is really quite nice, and it's a joint venture with the state, the governor's office, is the Ohio Women Veterans Conference. We've had three. Our fourth one will actually be on October the 8th, and we anticipate about 800 women coming from around the Ohio area. And for each conference, we've actually increased the attendance. And so the women are given a lot of information at these conferences in terms of what services and benefits that they have available in our communities at our, you know, state level, at our regional level, local level. So that is a major outreach that the VA is certainly participating in. As a matter of fact, it is actually the VA, we call it Vizintin, where it's all five of our regional hospitals, and then it's the governor's office. It's a joint venture that we have been able to do successfully, I would say, for the last several years here.
Before we go, then, let's just maybe look out to a little bit in the future as far as what's taking place with the VA and any new initiatives on the horizon.
One of the things that we're looking at Dayton is actually, you know, really expanding our services as much as possible to our women veterans and making sure that they have what we call the one-stop shop, where we don't have to source out or fee out, as we call it, a lot of the services that they have. We hope to, perhaps down the road, as our women veteran population increases, offer mammography on site. A lot of the things that we fee out, we're looking to try to see how we can keep those things in-house and have the expertise here for our women veterans so they don't have to travel far and they can, again, get everything in one location. So for us, as a facility, I think that's what we look for. I can tell you as a nation, that's what we're all looking for, a venue where women can get all the care they need in one location. As we move forward, we hope to serve our women and let them know that we indeed care about what their health care needs are and that we're here to serve them 100%.
And for any women veterans who may be listening to this broadcast and may not be aware of the services, what is the best thing to do to get in touch with those services?
They can call 937-268-6511, and they can dial my extension. It's 1907. And we are also located on the website at dayton.va.gov.
Maritha Trass is the Women Veterans Program Manager at the Dayton VA Center.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Today, I'm speaking with Joe Ingles with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
You reported this week on a debate regarding the recently passed election reform law. It hasn't yet been put into place. So Secretary of State Husted passed some directives to the County Board of Elections. What is it that he's told them?
Well, he's basically told the county board of elections, all the county board of elections, that they cannot send out these cards that some counties have been sending out. Now, these cards are sent to all the voters, and they say, hey, the election's coming up, and if you'd like an absentee ballot, please return this form, and we'll send you an absentee ballot. Sometimes, in some counties, the postage has been paid on these, but other counties don't send these out. So Secretary of State Husted has said, okay, since some of the counties can't afford to send these out, no one's sending them out. So if you're one of these voters who waits for the County Board of Elections to send you a card to remind you to order your absentee ballot, you're going to be out of luck this year because you're not going to get that form.
So, and as I understand it, this is part of the newly passed election reform law that hasn't gone into effect.
Right, right. There's an election reform law that has that provision as well as many other provisions that affect early absentee voting. For example, you've gone on a Saturday before the election or even a Sunday before the election to vote in person absentee. That won't be an option this year if this election reform law goes into place. Now, here's the tricky part of this, though. There's a group out there that's trying to get enough signatures. They need 231,000 valid signatures to put this on the ballot. If they are successful in getting those 231,000 valid signatures, what will happen is it can't go on the ballot this year, so it would have to go on the ballot in 2012, which means it would put the new law on hold, basically, for this year. So the current law would be in place, and none of these things like the early absentee in-person voting or anything like that would be affected unless there's a directive from Secretary of State Husted on that specific provision like there is on these absentee ballot forms.
So now what is this group saying about Secretary of State Husted's directives?
Well, they're not happy. They're obviously not happy because they see it as a way to circumvent the will of the voters. They say the voters should be allowed to go ahead and decide whether that's something that should be allowed or not. And Kathleen Clyde, state representative from up in northern Ohio, has contended that really the focus should be on having equal voting experiences, not having an equal voting process. Because as she says a lot of these larger counties, for example, if you put the same voting process in place for them as you have for a smaller county like, say, Benton County, there's a different outcome.
So I'm curious, how typical is it for the Secretary of State to issue directives like this?
Well, they do it all the time. And a Secretary of State can issue any number of directives. And most of the time, this kind of stuff is issued when county boards of elections have questions about how to do things. And in this case, indeed, there were two county boards of elections who were asking Secretary of State Husted, what do we do about this? The new law says this, the existing law says this, and, you know, we don't know how to handle this. So they looked to Secretary of State Husted to decide the issue, and he concurred and said, well, the new law, the way that it's handled in the new law is the way it should be. So he said, put that in place. We're not going to send out those absentee ballot request forms.
So can Husted actually issue more directives in the future?
He can, and that's exactly what the opponents of this new law are afraid of. They're afraid that Secretary of State Husted will go in and just issue all the components of the new law as directives. And if he does that, there's really no way to get around it. Now, when we asked Secretary of State Husted earlier about whether he would do that, he did not rule it out, but he certainly didn't say he was going to do any more. So he said, you know, if there are questions, he'll try to clarify them. But he says he's not right now, you know, going to go out and start implementing parts of the new law via directive.
I've been speaking with Joe Ingles with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. Before we go, here's Sarah Buckingham with a preview of tonight's Documentary Hour.
Tune in at 6 and 11 p.m. to celebrate the birth of the Peace Corps. 50 years ago today, the first groups of Peace Corps volunteers set out for service trips in Ghana and present-day Tanzania. Tonight's documentary tells the story of how it all began. In 1960, America was concerned about the spread of communism, but candidate Kennedy also encouraged students to take their skills to the Third World in the name of peace. That challenge would come back to Kennedy as a student proposal, the Peace Corps. We'll hear from those students, including Antioch University professor Al Guskin, on Kennedy and the Peace Corps, Idealism on the Ground, produced by Lester Graham and Michigan Radio, Kennedy and the Peace Corps, tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour.
Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.